morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of July 26, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this show. We've got a great panel lined up for you today. I want to remind everyone, though, that it's not just about the panel, it's also about the live online discussion that's taking place right here at Information Week. If you're listening to this and not yet in that discussion, well, we would love to have your voice there. All you have to do is type your comment, question, pithy observation, or wry witticism into the box labeled your post. Then be sure to click on that big red post button beneath the box. Now, joining me here in the virtual studio, we have a great lineup of Information Week editors. First, we have our queen of all things Microsoft, Kelly Sheridan, coming to us from the East Coast. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi there, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to be coming back to you because I have heard rumors that something big happened in the Microsoft world this week. So we'll get back to you in just a few minutes. Before we do, though, we want to welcome my fellow executive editor, David Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Looking forward, as always, to having your voice in the discussion and to hearing about the Geekend. Looking forward to that a lot. And we're pleased to have with us today the editorial director of Information Week, Susan Nunziata, coming to us from the West Coast. Susan, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. It's great to be here. It's been a while.
It has been. We're glad that your duties allowed you to stop by and join us today. We appreciate it every time you can join the discussion. Now, I spoke about this big thing that's going on in the world of Microsoft. Kelly, fill us in. What was going on out in Redmond?
Well, very, very few people know about this because we haven't covered it much, but Windows 10 launched this week. And of course, I'm joking. We've been following Windows 10 since Microsoft announced it was being developed back in January. And after months of development and getting feedback from Windows insiders and putting a lot of effort into this operating system, Microsoft rolled out Windows 10 this week to a very eager pool of users. We learned that as of the evening of July 30th, it had been running on 14 million PCs. So it's off to a good start. I know Microsoft wants to hit 1 billion devices by 2018, so we'll have to see if it can keep up the momentum.
Well, one of the things that they succeeded in doing was coming dangerously close to breaking the internet without involving cute kittens. And that's difficult to do. From what you have heard, have the people who wanted to download the upgrade been able to do so? Is the process going smoothly for most people as far as you can hear?
I've seen mixed reviews. Microsoft decided to roll out the operating system first to the people who have been testing it all these months just to kind of give it a final go through and ensure that it was compatible. And I believe it started rolling out to the public the night of the 29th or late in the day, at least on the East Coast. And I've seen that some people are running into a few glitches along the way, but I've also heard of people who have downloaded it and really enjoy using it. So I think it's a mixed bag for now. I know that as the rollout continues, Microsoft will continue updating according to like bug fixes or different problems that people are having. But so far, it seems to be going smoothly. I know that not nearly everyone who has registered for their upgrade has received it yet. So people are still getting their upgrade notifications and will probably continue to do so over the next few days.
I want to turn to some of our other panelists. Dave, I'll start with you. I know that you live in the Windows world for your desktop stuff. Have you made the leap to Windows 10, or are you planning to do so?
Actually, I'm one of those people who has signed up for the upgrade and has not gotten it yet. What I have gotten, funny enough, is an email telling me to be patient. And that it could be as many as 3 or 4 weeks before I get it, which I think is pretty interesting. Clearly, they don't know what I do for a living. But also, I signed up really very early in the program. Hopefully, it won't be a few weeks. I'm very interested in seeing it. I feel a little sort of naked without getting to try it. But from what I've heard from the people who have gotten to use it, reviews are pretty good about the experience. The thing I find the most interesting is that in previous existences as owning a PC, changing operating systems was a much bigger deal. You wanted to do a lot more backing things up than it looks like is going to be required for this, especially since all of us are backing things up in the cloud now. So my experience so far has been positive, except for the fact that I'm anxiously waiting in line to get a chance to use it.
Now, Susan, I know that you tend to keep your eyes on a much higher level of things around the IT world. From what you have heard and seen, do you think that corporations are already making plans to go to Windows 10, or is this another one of those let's wait and see opportunities for most companies? Do you think that we're going to have a lot of enterprises that remain on Windows 7 or, heaven help them, Windows 8 for a year or two to come?
Kurt, I think on the enterprise side, you're going to see a slower uptake. I'm sure there are some companies that are very, forward-thinking and in going to upgrade quickly. But for most, I think there's a lot of questions still to be explored about how it's going to play with their existing enterprise apps. I think the changes involving Internet Explorer, even though it's still going to be available, will raise some concerns. And I think, as you had pointed out, actually, in a really great piece that just went up today, there are some questions around things like security. And Kelly as well raised that question with the Wi-Fi Sense feature. So there's also a challenge around education, user education, as we saw with Windows 8 for those companies that did upgrade. That is not an easy row to hoe. So I think we'll see enterprises catching up a bit more slowly than the consumer market.
Well, Dave talked about the major changes, and Susan, you just mentioned the big training that has to go on. Kelly, I want to turn back to you, because one of the things that Microsoft has said is essentially that this is the last time Windows users will have to go through something like this, because, they say, this is the last version of Windows. And what they seem to mean is that from now on, everything's just going to be incrementally updated, and upgrades will happen slowly through the cloud. And so we won't have these big major point upgrades that have to be made. You've been watching Microsoft pretty closely, and you talk to them a lot. Do you think that's realistic? Do you think this really is the last time all of us will stand by and anxiously watch what's going on with a major upgrade? Or is this more of Nadella preaching the gospel of the cloud, while we all know that the reality is going to be that there are going to be, Windows 11, 12, 13 coming down the line?
I have like a two-sided answer to that. In terms of whether we'll see major updates rolling into Windows in the future, I think absolutely. This whole Windows as a Service deal, which is starting with Windows 10, as you said, means that upgrades will be delivered through the cloud, and people there won't be a whole massive celebration around the next version of Windows. Will Microsoft release a Windows 11, a Windows 21, a Windows 40? I'm not sure. But in terms of whether we'll see major updates that people have reason to be excited about, I think definitely. Microsoft has already given us word of an update called Project Redstone, which will deliver different features and support for devices that haven't even been created yet. And that should be rolling in next year, so not for a while, but we already learned about different devices like the Surface Hub and HoloLens, and the current version of Windows 10 doesn't really extensively support those devices, if at all. So I think that we have some, it's kind of like a touch and go thing, but I think that we will see major updates. I'm not sure whether we'll see them in the form of like different numbered versions of Windows. I don't think we will.
I think there's too much money on the table not to actually eventually call it Windows 11 or whatever. The free advertising, the marketing excitement, the thrill of a new version, it's too exciting to pass up. I don't think they can do it as often. I think it's pretty obvious that mobile is changing the perception of how often you can do these things. But even something as simple as Android rolling out Lollipop gets a certain amount of attention. A brand new huge update to an operating system gets around-the-clock coverage for months and months and months. I can't imagine Windows and Microsoft would turn that excitement down on purpose.
Yeah, I think to do so would be a really big risk on their part. But they have said that this is the last numbered version of Windows, so as of now, we won't see that, but I think that there's definitely room for change in that statement.
Right. I think they would have called it Windows then. If they were 100% sure that was true, they would have dropped all sense of numbers. They would have just called it Windows.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's hard to imagine 10 years from now still calling it Windows 10, or how are they going to market the HoloLens update? Is that what they're going to call it, or will that come in Windows 15? It's hard to say.
Right. And it's just a matter of the way consumers think about it. You're right. There's just no way we're going to be calling Windows 10 Windows 10 10 years from now. It just doesn't make any sense. We will have dropped the number even if they haven't.
I think your point is valid, Dave, about the marketing part of this, though I also think, in general, users are trained for updates, and I think folks like Microsoft are going to have to come up with new marketing hooks in the future. I mean, if you look at even the business model of a company such as Tesla, the automotive industry relied on the marketing push of new designs and new iterations year after year. Tesla has basically kept the same core design of its automobiles and releases software updates to change how the cars function. And so I think in a similar vein, we're going to see the same changes in terms of how companies like Microsoft think about future updates and how those are marketed and how to approach that in terms of what the users actually care about and want to see. So I think the game is going to change a bit. I do agree that Windows 10 won't be called Windows 10 if that was really their game plan. There are some naming changes that might have to happen, so we might see another big push somewhere along the line. But I think overall we're seeing a big sea change in how things are iterated and upgraded across the board with products, especially for consumers. So that's going to factor in, I think, to their plans, and we may see different ways of approaching the market going forward.
Makes you wonder if we will at some point start getting into things like Apple has done, where we now have Windows, our Mac OS 10, 10.2, coming out. Although I think we might just go with other geographical or geological features, you know, Windows 10 rocky outcrop or, you know, something like that. Some marketer will probably do a better job than I did on that. Well, with Windows 10 having actually hit the street, the question comes, were there any other stories in the IT world this week? And Susan, again, I'm going to turn to you because of where you sit and all the things you have to look at. Was there anything else going on this week that was worth noting?
Well, Kurt, absolutely. You know, Windows was the dominant factor across the board for a lot of folks here. But there were plenty of other interesting little bits and pieces. For instance, IBM and CVS have partnered on a patient care project that's based on Watson. And this is going, it's still early days for this, but it's going to be worked into the CVS Minute Clinics that are staffed by nurses. And I know our one of our community members actually on the call today, on the boards today rather, is Larry Loeb, who wrote the story about this. But this is a significant change, I think, in terms of how we start to think about healthcare, where we're going to be looking at these types of things to offload some of the healthcare expenses. And there's a lot of questions around, you know, privacy and security of data, but also just where the consumer fits in and where the payer-provider model fits into all of this. We also got a lot of attention for a piece on iPhone apps that will break your bank. So there's some really pricey iPhone apps out there that are a lot of fun to read about and consider if you really want to invest some dollars there. And then we also had a piece on what cloud native actually means to businesses and, you know, what it means to become a cloud native business. It's a piece that Charlie Babcock wrote for us that I think is worth reading in terms of looking forward to what our businesses are going to be looking like in the cloud.
Well, you mentioned something early on in your description of these stories, and I'm going to turn to Dave for a response on this because you talked about some of the privacy implications of the rapid big data analysis going on in healthcare. Dave, I know that you tend to be one of our privacy gurus here at Information Week, but here's my question. Is it time to admit that when it comes to privacy, that ship has sailed? Any notion of privacy that we had that's based on the way the world was before, let's call it 1990, should just be, you know, relegated to, how one would make mead at home out of the stuff that your feudal master left you. Should we all just admit that privacy's dead? And we're all happier because of it.
I don't know if it's time to go that far, but there are a couple of things I'd like to point out about that. The first is somebody approached me recently with a stat that I have not fact-checked, but it rings true to me, which is that 68% of corporate privacy breaches are in one way or another related to healthcare. So the idea that we're putting privacy in the hands of a retailer as opposed to a healthcare service provider doesn't scare me at all, because we've seen with Anthem Blue Shield and with Kaiser and all sorts of huge breaches that no one is safe from this. So whether it's CVS or whether it's Anthem doesn't really bother me very much. I am of the general impression or general feeling that some of the worst things about society come from a prejudice of a lack of knowledge. And one of the places I think that happens is with mental illness and with certain frightening illnesses like AIDS or something like that. And I'm wondering if getting rid of healthcare privacy laws wouldn't make us help realize that we all have things that are stigmatized and terrible, and maybe we'd actually learn from this that these things shouldn't be stigmatized. But that's a personal opinion. The most important thing I think about this is that this is a step towards what I think of as industrialized medicine. The problem with medicine is that it's a boutique system. We have all these millions of people, and they're going through their GP and then through their insurance to get to specialists and everything. And it's a really ridiculous system for minor aches and pains and vaccines and little things. If all you want is a flu shot, the experience is ridiculous through your insurance, right? But a flu shot really shouldn't be that way. One of the fabulous things about Watson and CVS and other pharmacies are doing this too, is we're going to take some of the easy stuff, some of the stuff that ought to be industrialized, things that should be able to be repeatable and doable, and give us another place and an easier place to handle those things. And for me, that if that can be done with credibility and security and safety, that's going to be a game-changing, wonderful thing about healthcare. So I'm willing to go through a few privacy hiccups, a few privacy bumps, especially since I think retail is doing as good a job as anybody with privacy, if that means some of the easiest things in our healthcare become easier and cheaper to get to.
Well, those do sound like very good things. The question of giving up privacy to get them still interests me. And Kelly, I'd like to turn to you because I think of you as a digital native. Unless I severely miss my guess, computers have been part of your life, essentially your whole life. So what is your thought about privacy? Is this something that worries you the way it does some people, or is it something where trading data or trading personal information for some sort of benefit is just the way business has always been done from your perspective?
I think it's interesting that comes up because I think from my perspective and from the perspective of a lot of my peers, like, I have very little problem exchanging personal information if it means it's going to result in some kind of benefit to me. And I think that in this respect, sacrificing personal data for the good of health is a no-brainer. You know, if you get the healthcare you need in less time than you would through a different, like, more secure method, I think that I would opt for that, you know, rather than waiting 2 weeks for a flu shot. If I could get a flu shot within a few days by giving someone my information, then I would definitely pick the latter. And I think it's a growing trend, especially among the generation, the incoming generation younger than me, is privacy is just kind of not non-existent, but it's definitely not a big concern. And I think in some respects, that's a really bad thing. But in some respects, people just don't mind giving out their phone numbers or their email addresses if it means that they're going to receive a coupon or some kind of benefit like that.
That sounds strangely rational. I'm not finding a lot to poke holes in your thinking with, but I know that I have my own rather blinkered attitude towards things. Susan, we haven't heard you talk about what you think about the whole privacy issue. I mean, from your perspective, are you going to leave the show and head out to your yurt in the Redwoods, or is privacy one of those things that you just accept as a, let's call it, changed concept from, say, the privacy notions that our parents had?
I guess a little bit of both. I want to run to the yurt and unplug, although I do recognize that the world is changing and that my views on privacy might be outdated. I like Dave's idea that open, visibility and transparency into illnesses might help alleviate stigmas. And I think that someday human thinking might evolve to that point, but at the present day, humans are not ready for that. And so I think such a thing would do much more harm than good in today's society, unfortunately. So I'm probably a bit of a Luddite when it comes to privacy, and I like to keep my personal information personal for the most part. So I'm going to fall on the opposite side of the argument here and say that, you know, I like my right to privacy and I want to keep it as much as possible. I do agree, though, that everybody either has been breached and doesn't know it yet or has been breached and told us. So I'm realistic in the sense that, you know, my information is probably out there anyway. But it's not like I'm about to post my prescription history on Facebook anytime soon and would prefer not to see it there.
Right, well, and this is the problem with the privacy argument, right, is that we have kind of conflated a few different things about privacy, right? One of the things we talk about a lot when we talk about privacy is what happens if our email or our address gets out into the public, and that allows more spam calls or more phishing emails or something. And that's one level of privacy, and that's an issue, right? But that can be dealt with on a technological basis. Then there's this person has a secret diagnosis, or this person likes something that society thinks is wrong to like, but isn't necessarily illegal to like. You know, this person owns, you know, this kind of crappy music we think makes them a bad person. Whatever it is, right? That's a different kind of privacy, right? That's we will change our thinking about your character if we know this information, right? And we should never get to a point where we trade the kind of information that changes people's perceptions of our character for convenience. What people are willing to trade generally for convenience is information that means they'll probably get more spam. So we need to make sure when we're talking about these things, we know the difference between things that endanger people on a personal level and people who endanger them on a sort of a business level.
That's a very good point, Dave. And it also gets back to this thing that Susan talked about, the doing more harm than good, basically the balance of benefit versus risk. And speaking of that, we're winding down towards the end of our show here, so it's time to turn our attention to today's Geekend. And any Geekend that is illustrated by a photograph of a latte foam grinning death skull gets my attention almost instantly. So what's going on with the Geekend this week?
The biggest problem I had, I swear I think I spent 45 minutes staring at latte art, deciding whether I wanted the skull or the fire-breathing dragon or the hobbit or the cute puppies. I mean, it was a really hard decision. Latte art has gotten to a level that I had not realized. but on a more serious level, the Geekend this week is about a finding from Italian researchers that shows that increasing your coffee intake later in life may lead to loss of mental function that may be related to Alzheimer's. Now, it's important to point out, as some people have already pointed out in the comments of the article, that we see all of these kinds of reports on an almost daily basis that X causes Y horrible thing, and then a few days later, it's retracted and all of that. But it's also important to note that that there are lots and lots of close longitudinal studies that kind of show lifestyle over time, and they do show that there are some diminished mental traits when it comes to going past one or two cups of coffee a day. So if you drink one or two cups of coffee a day, and by that I mean an actual cup, not just a giant Starbucks cup, but one or two cups a day routinely through your life, it's actually going to probably decrease your chances of dementia and decrease mental acuity. They're starting to see that if you increase later in life or you start drinking coffee late in life, you have two times as likely a chance to encounter some sort of mental issue. So we don't know exactly what that means yet, but considering every data center I've ever been in runs on coffee, it seemed like an important topic to talk about.
So you're saying that if you don't get more than two cups out of a pot of coffee, then it's possible that the cup you're using to measure your intake needs to be more carefully calibrated.
Right.
Ah.
Exactly. One of the things that's important to point out is the smallest cup of coffee that Starbucks sells is actually larger than a cup of coffee. I believe the Venti is three times, but don't quote me on that, but I think it's three times the size of what a cup of coffee is. A cup of coffee is 6 ounces. I believe the Venti is 18 ounces. I apologize if I'm incorrect on that, but the information is correct in the article. I'm just not sure I remember it correctly.
But Dave, the important thing to know is that if you have a Starbucks Gold card, your refill on your Venti coffee is free.
I think we should have a lot of fun with this because I think it's too soon to say, oh, don't drink coffee because of this. But this is the fun part about this, which is that most people need more and more and more coffee as they drink coffee. They don't just stop or they don't just hover, right? But that's the problem that seems to be in this study, is that it's not coffee that's the problem. It's continuing to increase your coffee, your caffeine intake that's the problem. And one of the reasons they think this is possibly true is that a small amount of caffeine helps your brain function. A large amount of caffeine, you know, hurts it. Nobody knows for sure. Nobody has a sense of the mechanism. And until we do, it's not right to say that coffee is a direct link. But it is a frightening concept that our habits around coffee seem to be exactly in line with what makes it dangerous.
Well, it's interesting for me because for reasons that have nothing to do with a European study, I have dropped my coffee intake to zero, and it has not made me happy. But I do find it interesting because you're right. Most people do, in fact, drink more coffee. And it's interesting because I remember it's now more than 20 years ago when the company that owns Information Week was still called CMP and owned by one family. We had the annual meeting of all of the company's employees, and they were giving out all kinds of statistics about the company. And one of them that I still remember very well was that the company had, in the previous year, purchased 1.4 million cups of coffee for its employees. And everyone in the audience, which was made up of writers and editors, sort of looked at one another and said, yeah, that seems about right. But I'm going to do my best to assume that this is a study that looked at correlation and didn't try to get to causality. Is that correct?
Absolutely. With a study like this, what they were doing is studying lifestyles in general. But like any study like this, it controls for some things. It can't control for everything. for all we know, these people actually also had a large intake of bananas. We don't know. We can't possibly. One of the things that's a problem with any of these lifestyle studies is controlling for what else might affect somebody, right? So I am in no way saying that quitting coffee is the right thing to do. Although what I have pointed out, and this is just generally true in life, that we find with almost everything that moderation is better. One or two cups of coffee seems like a great idea. Well, what are you going to do instead if you need that kick? And as boring and as sad as it sounds compared to your mojito or whatever you get at Starbucks, getting plenty of vitamin B, getting plenty of protein, getting a lot of water, those sorts of things are going to probably improve your energy and your productivity more than coffee. So if you can lower it to one or two cups a day and improve the way you eat, you're going to be healthier, you're going to be happier. Whether it actually affects your chances of dementia or Alzheimer's or not. So my apologies for preaching some health to people, but this is the kind of moderation study that's probably going to help you in the end.
Probably so, and we appreciate you looking out for us. Now, Kelly, I noticed that you've been strangely quiet through this discussion. Is it because you abstain from everything but pure mountain spring water, or were you gone to refill your giant mug of coffee while we were having most of this discussion?
I'm mostly just sitting here really sad that coffee can do something bad for you. I thought the study was interesting, and I take comfort in the fact that it's very hard to drink more coffee than I already do per day, so the idea of drinking more over time isn't too much of an issue. I can't remember when. I think I started drinking coffee when I was just starting high school, so it was like 14, 15 years old, and haven't really stopped since. So I hope that the health benefits of coffee outweigh the risks, but I also think it's interesting that Starbucks doesn't actually sell a coffee. I think we need to reevaluate our idea of what a cup of coffee is.
Well, I have heard, to be honest, I have heard some Europeans talk about the massive amount of coffee that Americans drink because, for example, French colleagues that I had felt that one cup in the morning, of which about half was milk, along with a buttered croissant, was the proper amount of coffee for a day. And I think I made some unkind comments about productivity on mainland Europe and then went ahead and drank my next liter of coffee. But it is interesting, as you say, to talk about the cultural differences and what precisely a cup means. I tend to go for the bigger is better school, but that may in fact lead to why my doctor asked me to cut back. Who knows? Who knows?
Right, and when we've seen this in America in everything, right? We see it in soda too, right? The what is now considered a small soda at a fast food restaurant was once larger than anything they actually sold, and now it's impossible to get anything in moderation. So it's not a surprise that we're doing this in all of our eating and drinking habits. And I noticed it's so sad that Susan had to mute herself and sob because I think that's the only way she could survive this conversation.
Well,
that is so completely true, Dave. I've been crying ever since I edited your article last night. So,
well, I think
be taking
before
my chances.
Any of us get so jittery or so forgetful that we aren't able to speak cogently or type our comments, it's probably time to bring it into this episode of Information Week Live. We really appreciate all of our panelists being with us, and we appreciate our audience as well. Now, before we go, let's go around the table. Kelly, tell us what you have coming up in the next week and where people can follow you on social media.
Well, next week I'm hoping to hear more customer reviews of Windows 10, and obviously we'll be looking out for updates on that. I heard that there is some kind of service package coming out to people who are currently using it next week, just to kind of address the different bugs and things that people are experiencing. And with that, there are no new features in this service pack. It's really just a kind of a bug fixer. And I'm hoping that comes out, because I'd like to learn more about it. And for that, and for all Microsoft updates and other tech updates, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Kelly Sheridan, K-E-L-L-Y-S-H-E-R-I-D-A-N, 22.
Kelly, thank you so much. And for our listeners, if you are indeed interested in anything that Microsoft does, you owe it to yourself to be following Kelly. She really does have a great perspective on things coming out of Microsoft, and is absolutely in tune with all of Redmond's moves. Dave, we appreciate yet another great geek in and a week of top-notch stories. So what's on tap for you in the coming week, and how do we follow you to find out what's going on a minute-by-minute basis?
Sure. This Sunday, I have an article about the revival of Google Glass and what I think Google can do to make it a little less creepy, that I think should be fun. I'm going to talk a little bit about career switching. There have been some interesting studies that have come out lately about people in their 30s looking to change careers, and I've also got what I think should be an interesting study on how to get into healthcare IT if you're in another branch of IT, that, speaking of career switching. And we're also going to be talking about the various different plans from Facebook and Google and Elon Musk and others on how to bring the internet to remote areas. Should be lots of fun. And you can get all of that from me at Geekend Dave on Twitter. That's weekend, but with a G. Dave, we should have a lot of other fun, good stuff next week.
Absolutely, Dave, thank you so much. And last but absolutely not least, Susan Nunziata, our editorial director. Now, Susan, I know that you don't get a chance to write nearly as much as you would like, but based on what you see around the Information Week realm, what should we be looking for on the site in the coming week?
Well, Kurt, since coffee was such a big discussion today, we have a great slideshow actually from you on how Java fits into the future for enterprise computing. And so that is going live on Sunday. We also have a piece coming up on cloud compliance nightmares from our own Andy Froelich. And a couple of other exciting things that I'll be working on include planning for the Information Week 2016 conference, which, believe it or not, we're already working on. And we will be having that in the first week of May in Las Vegas in conjunction with Interop. And we're going to be opening up the call for submissions for the Elite 100 Awards very soon. So I hope by next week's show, I'll have a link to share with everyone who wants to enter for the Elite 100. So that's some of the things that I have going on this week, and looking forward to being with you again next Friday, hopefully, if my schedule allows.
Kurt, can we never invite her back because of that Java and coffee pun? I think that was
great. Well, Dave, I tell you what, I'm going to leave that in your capable hands, because you're going to be hosting Information Week Live next week. I'm going to be off next week, so Dave will have his hand on the helm here at Information Week Live. So he will get the opportunity to tell his boss that she's not welcome on the air, and I look forward to him telling us where his next job is going to be. But as Susan said, for me, I do have that piece on Java coming up and concerning the Elite 100. I'm having the great pleasure of going back and looking at some of our honorees from 2015's edition of the Elite 100, finding all kinds of great stories among the projects and the IT teams that were recognized. That's going to be continuing. I'm doing one of those a week, and it sounds like we're probably going to be continuing to do those right up until time for the Elite 100 2016 edition to be announced, and that's a great thing. To keep up with what I'm doing and to just hear my ramblings 140 characters at a time, feel free to follow me on Twitter. That's at KG4GWA. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we will see you, or all of us except me, will see you next week right here.